Coming up, the new federal hate crime law. Does it threaten religious speech? And Muslim immigrants in Germany, where integration is talked about much more than it's practiced. Plus, the monastic life of Benedictine sisters.
The particular work of a monastery is community. And believe me, that's hard work.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. In Afghanistan, gunmen attacked a house where aid workers were staying and killed five UN staff members, including one American. The workers were to monitor Afghanistan's runoff presidential election this coming week. The attack prompted the UN to halt work and reevaluate its mission in that country. Meanwhile, President Obama traveled to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware to meet a plane carrying the bodies of Americans killed in Afghanistan. October has been the deadliest month for American troops in Afghanistan since the war began 8 years ago. Tuesday is Election Day, and religious leaders around the country are watching a referendum in Maine. Voters there will decide whether to uphold a new law that allows same-sex couples to marry. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Portland has been leading the opposition to the law that legislators approved this spring. Five other states allow gay marriage, but if Maine voters retain the law, it would be the first time same-sex marriage has been approved at the ballot box. Another gay rights issue that has divided people of faith is hate crime legislation. President Obama signed an expansion of the hate crime law that makes it a federal offense to attack people because of their sexual orientation. Some faith leaders welcomed the hate crime expansion, calling it a human rights victory, but others fear it would inhibit religious speech, even though the law explicitly says no one will be prosecuted for their beliefs or speech. Here to examine the issue is David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times, who has covered religious liberty questions. David, welcome. Why do what appear to be a fair number of religious conservatives think this new law or this extension of the law is wrong?
Well, if you believe yourself to be engaged in a culture war, a part of which is about the nature of sexuality and homosexuality, then you want to convey to your children, you want to teach your children that homosexuality is a sin, is something to be avoided, is not a natural kind of behavior. And now comes along a statute that is going to say homosexuals are a kind of person worthy of not only special respect, but special protection. You're going to see that as a defeat.
Mm-hmm. But what about seeing it as a threat to free speech, even to what a pastor might say in the pulpit? Some people have said pastors could be prosecuted for preaching the biblical view of homosexuality and other things like that. What about that?
That's overblown. Okay, I mean, clearly this does not suspend the First Amendment, and there's nobody, I think, on either side of the U.S. Senate or House of Representatives that intends to see preachers locked in jail. But we get overblown rhetoric on the left and the right. And the reason why this particular overblown rhetoric finds some purchase in the minds of people out there is because there is an element of thought involved. You know, what a hate crime does is it adds to the penalty to an aggressive or criminal act if the person who perpetrated it was motivated by a special disdain for the person they're hitting. You know, if someone is standing outside a bar saying, "I hate gay people," and then slugs a gay person, that's a hate crime. And it does have something to do with their reasoning and their thinking. So it's not ludicrous to think that a kind of thought is being penalized here.
Mm-hmm. And even that it might apply to a sermon?
Well, that goes a little bit far, but you know, suppose a pastor gave a sermon about how terrible sodomy is, and then later that day he happened to get into a fight with a gay man, well, he could be in trouble.
But what about just a parishioner who heard a sermon and then went out and did something? Would that then, would the pastor then be held responsible for that?
I'm not a lawyer, but that seems pretty far-fetched to me. However, on the other hand, you know, if you're an active participant in a congregation that spends a lot of time talking about what a sin sodomy is, and then you happen to get in an altercation with a gay man, I think that could plausibly raise questions. And if you want to, you know, if we're going to try and be as sympathetic as we can to the people who are concerned about this, let's look at college campuses. You know, that's a place where, within the context of the campus, people do regulate free speech, and they do regulate hate speech. And I think there are some people who think, well, goodness, I don't want my son or daughter to end up at a secular college where, by reading certain passages of the Bible, they're going to trigger, you know, speech codes. So they're not, it's not completely irrational to feel like there's something at stake here. Mm-hmm.
David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times, many thanks. In other news, the Reverend Bernice King has been elected to lead the civil rights organization co-founded by her late father, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. She'll be the first woman to head the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the second King child to do so. Her brother, Martin Luther King III, also served as president. Bernice King is a Baptist minister in Georgia and a motivational speaker known for her socially conservative views and fiery preaching. She called her leadership of the SCLC a, quote, destiny call. There were mixed reactions to the Vatican's announcement last week that the Catholic Church will make it easier for Anglicans to convert. The church would allow former Anglicans to preserve elements of their liturgy and would also permit more married clergy to become Catholic priests, though not bishops. Some conservative Anglicans welcomed the news because they agree with the Vatican on gay issues, among other theological points. Others, including many disaffected American Episcopalians, said they've already found a home within conservative coalitions. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, criticized the Vatican for not consulting Anglican leadership. At the same time, Carey said that for many traditionalist Anglicans, the Vatican's offer was, quote, worth considering. One of the most troubling issues in many countries of Western Europe is how to deal with the large and growing population of Muslim immigrants. It's a major concern in Germany, where the majority talks of integration but doesn't always practice it. Meanwhile, Muslims say they want integration and equal opportunity, but they don't want to lose their Muslim identity. Deborah Potter reports from Berlin.
Almost 90% of the students at Rainbow Elementary School in Berlin are from immigrant families, most of them Muslim. Fitting in can be tough because a lot of them can't speak German, even though many of their families have been here for decades.
When I started being a teacher more than 30 years ago, I thought that problem we won't have in 10 years. They all will speak German, but they don't.
Heidrun Böhmer has watched her students struggle to succeed. About 75% never finish high school, more than double the national rate. In school and the outside world, their chances are limited by a complicated mix of social and economic issues, religion, and history. Muslim immigrants, mainly from Turkey, first came here in large numbers in the 1960s, when Germany was facing a severe labor shortage. They were called guest workers, but most of them never went home. Instead, they brought their families and settled in neighborhoods like Neukölln in Berlin, where shop signs are in Turkish and Arabic, and satellite dishes bring in programs from back home. Storefront mosques are tucked behind fruit stands. Until 10 years ago, immigrants could not become German citizens, and they still don't have a chance at most government jobs. Integration just hasn't happened.
People who live here since 40, 50 years, were born here in the third generation, are understood as foreigners, are understood as immigrants, while they are not. They just have a different faith. So this debate leads to people thinking about their neighbors as problematic because they do have a different faith.
Today, Germany has about 4 million Muslims, 5% of the population, making Islam the second largest religion. Germany has more Muslims than Lebanon and twice as many mosques as the United States. Young Muslims here describe themselves as more religious than their parents in a country where few Christians go to church. Berlin is sometimes called the atheist capital of Europe. But while religious freedom is enshrined in the German constitution, public schools are required to offer Christian religious instruction. Leaders of Muslim organizations are now demanding Islamic religious instruction as well, and tensions are growing.
The number of people that don't want to live together with Muslims, that don't want to have a mosque in their neighborhood, this number is rising.
According to public opinion polls, the vast majority of Germans associate Islam with violence and terrorism, and they resent what they see as too many Muslims sponging off the German welfare system. But the country's strong social safety net may be one reason why Germany has not seen the kind of violence that scorched Muslim neighborhoods in France a few years ago. Young Muslims there took to the streets angry about unemployment and police brutality. Nothing like that has happened in Germany, even though the jobless rate in some Muslim neighborhoods hovers near 50%.
If there is no easy opportunity, or if they can't make as much money as they get from the state as welfare money, they don't work, of course. It's not that they don't want to work, it's just reasoning, and they are rational people.
Barbara Yon has spent 30 years dealing with integration issues, a task complicated by the fact that Germany has never had a policy of limiting immigration.
It's part of our history of Nazi times. We were guilty, and we still feel guilty, especially when it comes to minorities and to accepting people who are persecuted. And once we were ourselves able to give it, we could hardly say no. And now immigrants come and they want to live in Germany, they want to be proud of this country, and the Germans themselves are not. So integration is difficult for these minorities.
Gut, dann herzlich willkommen. Und wie geht's Ihnen?
The government is now trying to help, offering subsidized language and culture classes for adults at a cost of about $200 million a year. But those who sign up don't always come.
Well, some of them, they're not interested. But some of them, they have many problems here, the immigrations. Problems that we can't understand. Problems with the Office of Foreign Affairs, problems with job, to find a job.
The problems are all too apparent to Ender Chetin, who says Muslims want more than equal job opportunities. They want to feel truly accepted.
We feel many, many attacks, not violence, but in words. Feel many, many kind of discrimination. This make us also afraid a little bit, as a distance. That's not so good for integration. Wenn ihr Fragen habt, könnt ihr auch zwischendurch fragen.
Chetin was born in Germany, but chose to retain his parents' Turkish citizenship rather than give it up as required by law to become a German citizen. As a spokesman for the biggest mosque in Berlin, he now gives tours to school groups, hoping to make Islam seem less threatening.
We have many, many questions also in this year's, and the questions are always the same. The questions is terrorism and Islam. Can it be together?
Not every Muslim are terrorists, something like that, yeah? And sometimes in the TV it looks like that, every Muslim it's like terrorist. It's not true.
Erdinç Sinac came here from Turkey at age 5 and recently became a German citizen.
Yeah. I go to school, learn very good German. For me, it's okay, and I have no problems.
In the long term, Germany needs immigrants. The country's birth rate is one of the lowest in Europe, the cost of its social programs among the highest.
We have to consider these people as our future, too. They are their children, the children of the immigrants, are our children, are the children in Germany. They are the children of everybody, and we have to care for them and look after them and give them a better education, give them a good education. So why shouldn't they be successful? There is everything in human nature that can make them successful, and we are a a country that has money and we have educators, so we should improve our system.
But there's a long way to go. Other Western democracies have similar problems, but a new study by an international economic group says Germany does about the worst job of providing equal opportunities for immigrants and their children. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Deborah Potter in Berlin.
In the world of any day's news, it's hard to remember that there are communities that are not driven by greed and hate and violence, that are not preoccupied with noise and things. But such places do exist, as Judy Valente reports from Mount St. Scholastica Monastery in Atchison, Kansas, where she visited the Benedictine sisters who live there and pray for all the rest of us.
78-year-old Sister Phyllis is near death. Over a period of 3 days, around the clock, the sisters have been taking turns keeping vigil at her bedside.
In our monastery, sisters do not die alone. We stay with the sisters night and day so that they know, they're comforted by the fact that they joined a community, and as community, they're going to go home. The real home that we've been waiting for.
The Sisters of Mount St. Scholastica die much as they live, peacefully, prayerfully, and surrounded by community. It's a way of life that Benedictine monasteries have shown the world for more than 15 centuries, and it's a message that still resonates.
When I look at the condition of the world today, I see a world where there's violence, one where there's greed, one where there's selfishness, but also one where there's a craving for a rejuvenation of family life, a rejuvenation of spiritual life. It speaks to me of the need more than ever of a monastic presence in this world.
Monasteries such as this one stand in contrast to the prevailing culture. They value community over competition, service over self-interest. And in a world of internet, cell phones, and 24-hour talk, they stress listening and silence.
It's a way of life here. It's an absence of noise and clutter. And we come together first, and we're just silent. We're in the presence of God. It's not a deadly silence. It's a very reverent and beautiful silence. We don't need noise to be productive. It's just the opposite. We don't need noise to communicate. It's just the opposite. Monastic life is a life of living together in prayer and community. We as Benedictines, we monastics, we're not founded to do a particular work. The particular work of a monastery is community. And believe me, that's hard work. Living with 165 women is hard work.
Ever faithful God, bless the food we are about to eat and unite us in mind and heart to your Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord.
The common table is central to who we are. But you listen, and you listen with the ear of your heart. You listen with what's inside you. That's what it means to be a listening person, and that's going to happen in the dining room.
Sister Anne says these and other practices at the monastery can be applied to family life and even to the professional world.
You bring in everybody into a decision and learn from the newest members, as well as the wisdom of the older members and everything in between. So you have prioresses and former prioresses and PhDs in English and math doing dishes, along with those that just enter that don't have those same higher degrees. That's a radically different way than a top-down way of doing business.
The monastery reflects a spiritual way of life, but one that also contains practical wisdom.
A major countercultural difference is that we hold things in common. If I have a computer, if I have a laptop, it's because it's for the use of the community. We don't need things. We need the gospel call, and we need one another.
The sisters do a variety of work. They teach at Benedictine College. They operate a women's center in nearby Kansas City, Kansas, where volunteers teach money management.
Budgeting is simple, but it will bring you know, a little bit of the peace of mind to your house.
English as a second language.
Ought.
And provide child care for mothers taking classes. Others work in the medical profession or in massage therapy. Until recently, one was even a firefighter, another a funeral director. But the most important work of the monastery is prayer.
We use the words of the Psalms and of the Scriptures that nurture us, that give us life, that give us meaning. Our life is about seeking God together and bringing that God into our hearts. It's so profound, it's hard to even explain. But it's the dailiness of the prayer. It's that we need the prayer.
Monastic life began to flourish after the fall of the Roman Empire. Men and women retreated to the desert to live solitary lives of prayer and penance. In the 6th century, Benedict of Nursia, known for his spiritual wisdom, left the solitary life behind and founded communities where like-minded individuals could seek learning, find security, and live a life of prayer. Today, every monastic order in the world, whether Benedictine or not, follows Benedict's model to some extent. A young woman comes to the monastery for music lessons from Sister Joachim Holthaus, a composer. Ever since the time of Saint Benedict, monasteries have been important centers of learning and culture. This is Sister Paula Howard. 8 years ago, at age 77, she discovered her talent for creating icons, which the monastery then sells. She's done nearly 200.
Well, I think all appreciation of beauty lifts your heart, that beauty belongs here. It's a foretaste of heaven, we hope, and I just think that beauty is an image of God.
Both artistic beauty and the beauty of nature.
A contemplative life is being in tune with the spirit, in tune with nature, in tune with creation. Everything that we do has meaning, and it has meaning because we're intentionally trying to be more prayerful. You can live a contemplative life outside of a monastery. As a matter of fact, that is our hope, that people can come here and find a sense of peace.
The sisters earn some income by offering spiritual retreats. These high school girls are spending several days here. The monastery has 70 lay employees and an annual budget of $4 million. Most of it goes toward operating a nursing care facility for elderly sisters. The monastery also receives donations and bequests and government funding for its nursing home. Another source of income? The salaries of sisters who do outside work, like Sister Mary Pallarino, a clinical social worker.
You could do this work as a lay person. I'm wondering what you think being a sister brings to this.
You know, I really don't think I could do it as holistically and as comprehensively unless I were a member of my community and living the Benedictine way of life.
Mount St. Scholastica is nearly 150 years old. Some 2,000 women religious have passed through its doors. Today, the vast majority of the sisters here are over the age of 55.
I do get concerned about people not joining us, and I don't understand that. I mean, because it seems like young people today are, they seek and they have a hunger for community, for prayer life, for social justice issues. They have a hunger to follow something greater. We have that.
Sister Ann Shepherd.
Where's it going to go in the future? It's going to go wherever God takes us. We're going to be smaller. We're going to be just as vibrant. But it's not easy. Any genuine commitment isn't easy. The gift of unselfishness is the reason we make a promise to be faithful for all our lives, every day of our lives.
These sisters believe that as long as there's a need in the world for quietude, simplicity, balance, prayer, and community, there will always be a purpose to monastic life. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Judy Valente at Mount St. Scholastica in Atchison, Kansas.
On our calendar, on Sunday, All Saints Day, when Western Christians honor saints and martyrs, and on Monday, All Souls Day, when Catholics especially pray for those who've died but haven't yet entered heaven. Also on Monday, Sikhs celebrate the birthday of their founder, Guru Nanak. It's one of their most important holidays and is marked with prayers and festive meals. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website, including a special essay by Judy Valente on the meaning of monastic life. You can comment on our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org.